Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I know you both are experienced here and know that you should state your names when you begin your arguments. Podium goes up and down if you need to adjust the height. And the next case is State of Minnesota versus Michael Anthony Pitts, A18-1675. We are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, Rachel Bond representing the appellant Anthony Pitts, Michael Anthony Pitts. Mr. Pitts was convicted of a single count of promotion of prostitution after a jury trial in Hennepin County. And the main issue in this appeal, as it was at trial, is whether the conduct at issue amounts to procures a patron for a prostitute within the meaning of the statute. It does not. Mr. Pitts's conviction should be reversed. In the alternative, we ask that you do at least reverse and remand for a new trial because of the prejudicial misconduct and for resentencing because of the sentencing issues. I'd like to start with the sufficiency of the evidence issue. And this issue is in many ways a narrow issue as it comes before the court. The evidence is, I would say, basically undisputed, and it revolves around this 90-second interaction that's captured on Exhibit 1, which is the body cam of the undercover officer. And there fundamentally are two reasons why this does not prove procures a patron for a prostitute, which is the sole basis on which this case went to the jury. One relates to the definition of procure and how much intentional or directed conduct is required by that. And second, no matter how we define procure, the thing that must be procured is the patron, not the prostitute. And so under either one of those reasonings, the evidence is insufficient. My position and what I'd ask this court to do is adopt a definite, as we know, procure is not defined. It is then appropriate for this court, in order to determine whether the evidence is sufficient, is to interpret the meaning of that word. And I'm asking for the court to adopt a definition that is actually reflected, I think, in both the American Heritage and the Merriam-Webster dictionary that both parties have offered, which is obtain or acquire by some special care or special effort. And I think that is the common and ordinary meaning of the word procure. It is different than solicit. For me, that makes sense to me. Procure involves some action, some direction, some intentionality.
Well, could I just ask you, because it looks like, I mean, I'm looking at this transcript, and it looks like there is a request for a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the inference is that I want a woman for sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then the response from your client was, I got you one. I mean, and calls a woman over. Is that enough? I mean, and then we know later that he has a relationship with this woman, and she actually says he knows I'm doing prostitution.
I agree
with those facts that are clearly in the transcript, mm-hmm. Is that enough?
No, it is not.
Why isn't it?
Because
enough?
Mr. Pitts was not convicted of the provision of the statute that charges soliciting or inducing a prostitute to commit an act of prostitution. That arguably may have been what happened here. What he's convicted of is procuring a patron, and he does nothing. He is not the one that initiates the discussion about a prostitute. He has no involvement in the discussion about money. He does not do anything to ask.
But he said, officer asks, you have a bitch for me? Uh-huh. Officer, what's that? appellant how much money you got.
That it is undisputed, Your Honor, that that is about the drugs.
No, because it follows right. That's not how I read it. Tell me.
Well, I would refer to the undercover officer's testimony.
I know, but well, the jury also looked at the camera video and what was said that night.
And I completely agreed. What we see on the camera video is there is a discussion between the undercover officer and my client that is about drugs. And then it becomes a little confused because then the woman comes over and there is a parallel discussion going on between the woman and the undercover officer about sex. The officer...
The officer says, after the drug discussion, any bitches out here, you know I can get appellant. What you try and do... Trying to get some ass. Kay, got a bitch for me. Uh-huh. What's that? How much money you got, your client? I got 40.
And, Your Honor, my position is the evidence is undisputed that that is about the drugs. And I would refer the court.
Why is that undisputed?
Because, number one, the officer testified, and this is at page 66. Officer, the $40 that's mentioned in the transcript, that was for what you believed was drugs. Is that correct? Correct. Then at page 68, she's the one who came up and initiated any conversation about money for sex, correct? Correct. Mr. Pitts never discussed with you anything about money for sex. I don't recall him discussing anything about it, but he did call her over. And then, of course, the woman's testimony, and is clear from Exhibit 2, is that then she comes up and negotiates a completely different price, not $40, for sex. And so there is no, I very much disagree that there's any evidence at this point, as it came in at trial, that discussion about money relates to the drugs.
Well, except the prosecutor argued it could be either, that if you look at that transcript, it could be either, and the jury obviously considered that issue and decided it against your client. I mean, they don't necessarily have to accept what the officer said about the 40. If they have the transcript, and it could be interpreted either way, right?
That addresses my misconduct argument. I think it is significant both to the misconduct argument and as to how we're reading the evidence now, that this argument that the prosecutor makes in closing that the $40 and the discussion with Mr. Pitts was about prostitution, that is never mentioned at any other time. It is not the theory in opening. It is not the theory in the prosecutor's rebuttal when the defense calls him and says that is absolutely not true.
Well, as I hear your argument, you think the biggest omission here was what you claim was no evidence that your client discussed price. You're claiming that.
I think that's part of it.
What is the rest?
The rest of it is that he does nothing to this patron is there. And this patron initiates the first conversation with my client about a prostitute. And so my client did nothing to procure that patron.
Except isn't procure, I mean, he put them together, though. I mean, he did go, it wasn't like he was just standing there and she happened to be there. He actually called her over. Isn't that a procurement?
That is not a procurement, I would say. A procurement, because, again, the statute doesn't say procure the prostitute. The statute says procure the patron. And, again, there is a different subdivision of this statute.
The officer is a patron.
Pardon me?
You're the officer is a patron.
Correct. I agree. But this whole argument that we can affirm this conviction, he is guilty because he introduced or he called over Ms. Bullhead, reads out the language of the statute, because the statute, the provision that the state charged him with and he's convicted of, is not procure a prostitute at the request of a patron. The statute says procure a patron for a prostitute. And so I think we've got the wording of that statute and what procure means. I think that, I mean, If this court reads the evidence, and I very strongly do not believe that is either how the evidence was presented at trial, I don't think the jury would have found that way. It's not how the state argued the case that it was my client involved in this $40 for that was for drugs or for sex, excuse me. So well, I think that would be, I really think that that would be a reading of the record that is not how the evidence came in and not how the state's witnesses, the officer, the witness, the person there during the interaction, engaging in the discussion with both my client and Ms. Bullhead, viewed that discussion about the money. And I think that's very significant. So without that, but I suppose even with that, to answer your question, there is nothing else, and we can look at the Mount Pettit case, which is a published case where this court affirms sufficiency of the evidence for procuring a patron. And what we see is the defendant arranging a date, the defendant initiating the conversation with the patron.
Let me ask you this. I mean, if you had a guy standing on a corner and the neighborhood knows he stands there, and people come up and say, you got a woman for me or you got someone for me, and he calls over like he did multiple women,
well,
would you say that, would you have any problem with that being a procurement?
I think the case might change if there were multiple instances of observed conduct. My concern is I think that conduct could be criminal, but not under procurement. Because what is the defendant doing in that situation to get or obtain a patron? And if it's multiple instances and there's testimony introduced at trial of he is out there every day, every night, and he waits and people know that he's the guy to go to and he can hook you up with somebody, that might be a different case.
So your client was convicted under 609.322 subdivision 1A2.
Correct.
And that reads, whoever, while acting, blah, 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 promotes, and this is the subdivision 2 part, or sub 2, promotes the prostitution of an individual.
Correct. And then we go to the definition statute of promoting prostitution of an individual, and that subdivision 7, paren 1,
solicits or procures patrons for a prostitute.
Correct. And they rule, everyone agreed to take out solicit, that this was not a solicit case, and so the only basis that went to the jury was procures patrons for a prostitute. And one of the...
Promoting the prostitution of an individual.
No, it's how you promote the prostitution. How...
I understand that, but he was convicted under the statute that says promotes the prostitution of an individual.
Correct.
By procuring
Correct.
A patron.
I agree with that, yep. And my point about the other subdivision of the statute is subdivision 1A paren 1, which says solicits or induces an individual to practice prostitution. So I think when the state argues, well, you know, and this is a little bit the concern I hear from the court, come on, this is street level, everyday garden variety street level prostitution. We know what's going on here. That may be, and the way to get at that behavior is probably that paren 1, where what we are targeting is the actor, the defendant's conduct vis-a-vis a prostitute, getting her to engage in prostitution. But that's not where we are. We are under procure. So whether the court reads and defines procure expansively, which I think it should, or whether it just does a more simple get or obtain a patron, the thing that is being obtained has to be the patron, not the prostitute. And that has been my concern with this case. The first time I cracked this file is I said, "This, I don't think this is right. I think they did this wrong."
Is there a specific statute making it illegal to procure a prostitute?
To procure, I guess I don't know. I don't think it's in these, if you're not the patron, you mean. Yeah. I don't know. I guess I don't know.
I mean, you're arguing that that's the effect what occurred here, that there is a procurement of a prostitute as opposed to a procurement of a patron.
Correct.
And my question is, did the legislature intend to have a broad... definition of patron here? If it had a specific statute that had procuring a prostitute, then it would give some credence to the idea that this was just procuring patrons, not prostitutes.
Well, I think under a plain language analysis, which is certainly where we are, the subdivision that my client is convicted of is procures a patron. I don't know off the top of my head whether there is another version of this statute that says procure a prostitute. I do think, arguably, that the conduct here, I think the legislature probably, arguably, did want to criminalize the conduct here, but it is not because you're procuring a patron. It's because you're inducing or soliciting the prostitute to commit an act of prostitution.
That's the legislative determination, that when you're dealing with the situation we have here, it is a soliciting one rather than a procuring of a patron. Soliciting a prostitute.
I'm not understanding your question fully. I think it is a fair read of this statute to say the legislature may have wanted to criminalize this conduct right here. Well, I don't see the word procure in the provision that I think arguably applies to this conduct.
Could they have applied as a soliciting then?
I think it could have. As far as the actions vis-a-vis the prostitute, yes. I think arguably it could have been solicit or induce the prostitute to commit prostitution. You know, the solicit did not go to this jury, so we certainly cannot affirm the conviction based on the fact that my client solicited the patron.
It wasn't charged out as soliciting, it was charged out.
It was originally charged out under this paren of solicit or procure a patron for a prostitute.
The statute says solicit or procure. Is that typical lawyerese where you say the same thing twice, two different, are these different?
So I don't think there's an answer to that in the law. I was thinking about that last night. I think, to me, procure, solicit is more of a verbal or an ask, a request. Procure to me, which is why I think it involves or requires a more expansive definition, procure to me invokes some sort of more intentional and meaningful action that doesn't have to be a verbal solicit. I'm out of...
More than solicit.
I think so.
In some way and puts the deal together or whatever.
I think so. It's arranging a date. It's taking actions that are not, for instance, what we don't have in this case again, which is my client saying first to this undercover officer, are you looking for a girl? I think that would be soliciting under the subdivision he was convicted of. But again, that's not what he was charged with. That's not what he was convicted of. That is not the way that this court can affirm the evidence. Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Just use it.
May it please the court, Judge Riley, good morning. My name is John Munnins. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in today's case.
Do you have the complaint in front of you?
I do not, Judge. Do you have a question about the complaint? I might be able to answer anyway.
Does the complaint focus on soliciting?
As noted, Judge, the subdivision for the definition of promoting prostitution, subdivision 7-1, paren 1 under 609.321, notes both solicit or procure. Mm-hmm. So it provides both, so the complaint would have listed...
Are those two different concepts?
I do believe they are, actually, yes.
Lawyeries repeating things over until everybody's sick of it.
Right, it's not a dominion and control or willful and wanton type of situation.
So was this charged out then simply as a procure, or was it charged out as a solicit or procure?
I mean, it was charged as a solicit or procures. However, I would just note...
Two different events. Did you charge them in separate counts?
Most likely not, because just factually speaking, a defendant is only going to commit one or the other. If you solicit someone, that would be as though the defendant flagged down Officer Folks here and said, hey, you know, are you looking for a girl? I have one, right? Then he's soliciting a patron. He's calling that patron in to see if that patron would like to have a prostitute, essentially. To procure is to simply obtain.
See, I'm troubled by the idea that what happened here is he obtained a prostitute. He's procured a prostitute, but did he procure a patron?
He did, Your Honor.
Why?
Essentially what happens, and
he's
it's...
He's not the patron.
Correct. But when Officer Folks arrives at the scene there, and he indicates to the defendant that he is looking for a girl, basically what the defendant has now is he's got a patron that he knows is looking for a prostitute, and he has a girl over here that he knows is a prostitute. So he obtains this patron for the girl by introducing the two, essentially. So he obtains that patron.
So by calling the girl, he obtained the patron.
Correct. And I would note, Your Honor, just with regard to the solicit versus procure, the defense actually objected to submitting both theories, solicit or procure. That was prior to jury instructions on pages 95 and 96 of the transcript. There's no record made of a ruling or anything. However, when the jury instructions are read on page 112, the judge does only submit the theory of procure.
It appears to me that if, in fact, or means two different kinds of conduct, then they shouldn't have been in one count. It should have been separate counts. If it's describing two different types of conduct, shouldn't it?
Theoretically, if you had two different kind of circumstances, that would be, you know, if he had two counts, one in which he solicited a patron, one in which he procured, I would agree, you would need two counts there.
If there's two counts, be factually the same, but the legal issue is different. Isn't that when you count plead?
Well, it's the same type of thing you would do in a domestic case where you might have a fear theory or a harm theory. The statute itself provides you both avenues. However, if you are going to advance both theories, you should probably charge both for unanimity's sake. And here we have unanimity. The jury was only given the question of procurement, not solicitation. We see this all the time in statutes where they have these disjunctive clauses that allow the charge to be proved one or another. And I think assault and domestic assault is probably the most kind of classic example there, where you either intend to introduce fear of bodily harm to a victim or actually cause bodily harm to them. It's one charge, it's one count, but if you were to submit it, you would not be allowed to argue both theories. You would have a unanimity issue there. And so here, it was only submitted under one. There's no problem there. But the charge would still be, you know, regardless, every time a prosecutor has to charge this offense, they're going to charge under that subdivision 7, paren 1 to appropriately designate the type of promoting prostitution that the state is pursuing.
Can you have a procurement without a discussion of how much it's going to cost?
Absolutely. And actually, Montpita suggests that very fact. Montpita is actually very informative because he commits two forms of promotion of prostitution. They discuss how he has a leased premise that they use for prostitution. That's one theory of promotion of prostitution. But he also procures a patron in that he meets these two prostitutes and then calls his friend and basically just does an introduction between the two. He in no way has anything to do with any exchange of money. He doesn't take any profit. He doesn't pay for his friend. They have absolutely nothing. He literally just does the introduction. And that was sufficient to show that he promoted prostitution under the 7, paren 1.
Would you agree with Ms. Bond's characterization of that case as he did a lot more than her client did?
Only in that he did, because he had a second provision that he could have been prosecuted under, and he himself also engaged as a client of prostitution. He himself was a patron, which was the issue in the case. He argued essentially, well, I'm a patron, and the subdivision does specifically exclude patrons from promotion of prostitution, so that way you can't have kind of two competing theories as to what's going on here. But with regard to that second prostitute, the one that he didn't engage in any sex acts with, he procured the patron for that prostitute. With respect to that, that's really all he did. He introduced the two. He was also guilty because he and his friends apparently leased this apartment for a bachelor pad. But again, that would be under a different subdivision. So, and they note in Montpita that he committed promotion of prostitution in two different ways. I do want to address, and I'll pivot into the misconduct claim, this argument over the inference that can be made about the exchange between Mr. Pitts and the undercover officer on the body camera. I certainly do concede that the officer says he thought it was about drugs, although he does then later note that he wasn't sure if he had ever discussed money with Mr. Pitts. But more importantly, if your honors just simply look at the exchange on the camera, if you watch the video, it's difficult because they're talking about several things at once. And it certainly seems like a reasonable inference that they could have been theoretically talking about money for sex. And whether or not the jury even accepted that, it doesn't matter because, as Judge Hooten noted, he doesn't actually have to have any partaking in this process of how much or for what exactly, just the actual sex acts of prostitution, which is exactly what Officer Folks informs him of. I'm here, I'm looking for a girl. Do you have a girl for me? And essentially, like I say, Mr. Pitts is then aware that he has someone, he knows he's got a patron, he knows he's got a prostitute, and he introduces them. Watching the tape, it does seem as though it could very reasonably be inferred that they were talking about how much to pay for Ms. Bullhead, because he says, do you have a girl? Uh-huh. And he says, and then it pivots, he calls the girl over and says, oh, how much? And then they say 40. The jury is allowed to view that tape. They viewed it again during their deliberations. They are allowed to make whatever inferences they want from the evidence submitted to them. They can disregard all the arguments of both counsel and completely ignore it. But they are allowed to view that tape and determine what happened. And what happened on it is Mr. Pitts knew he had a patron, and he got that patron to go to a prostitute, which is why they convicted him.
And we are to accept whatever inferences are consistent with the verdict? Is that it?
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, when you're trying to overturn a jury verdict, the appellant bears a heavy burden to show that this jury basically had kind of no reason to find this verdict. And here, even there's evidence of Ms. Bullhead on the night of in Exhibit 2 saying that she has nothing to do with Mr. Pitts and he doesn't approve of her prostitution and all that. But then she explains that all away at the trial and says, well, yeah, that's bad for business. I lose my clients if I do that, and I don't want to do it. And so the jury quite clearly credited her testimony at trial when they got to see her in person, hear from her, hear her tone, watch her demeanor, and rather than believe the statements she made in Exhibit 2, they believe the statements she made at trial. With respect to the alleged misconduct, the state would request that you find that there was simply no error committed here. In particular, the first alleged error was that the prosecutor in his closing argument said that Mr. Pitts was involved in prostitution and drug dealing. And as I note in my brief, it's a simple syllogism of Officer Severance when he talks about how they identify targets. They have cameras on the streets, they're watching to see what happens, and they find Mr. Pitts. And he says they're looking for individuals they know to be involved in drug dealing and prostitution. The question basically comes, did you identify a target based on your observances? Yes, we did, Mr. Pitts. Simply put, when the prosecutor in his closing argument then argues they knew that he was engaged in prostitution, that's supported by the record. It was not objected to at the time the evidence came in. It's simply a part of the conduct that happened and the investigation that night. There's nothing about it that is improper. There's no error. It's not arguing facts not in evidence or making unreasonable inferences. And similarly, too, with the exhibit, and we can argue about what those inferences were, and maybe Officer Folks is slightly more credible or more persuasive, but attorneys don't need to argue the most persuasive theories of their case. They can argue any rational inference based on the evidence presented, and that's in Smith. That's precisely what the prosecutor did here in this case. So we would ask that you find no error in his closing argument. And should the court find that it is error, I would just note it is not harmless because the entire interaction is on camera. It's fairly unique in many ways. You don't get a lot of cases where the entire crime is essentially caught on camera, and we have this entire interaction.
Yes, ma'am. Was there, I know that there's quoted language in both briefs, actually. Was there any discussion on camera with regard to the drug deal that took place?
Yeah, he does ask for two dubs, which they explain later as well what dubs are. And the defense during cross-examination of Officer Folks inquires about whether or not he knew it was drugs or whether or not the drugs were tested. I mean, there's certainly evidence that part of what was going on was a drug deal. So, I mean, and that would be an inference that either side could argue.
And did the jury hear the entire, did they see the entire video?
Well, they would have seen the entire video that's transcribed and submitted to the court in Exhibit 1 and 1A. The entire video likely would have been, you know, Officer Folks leaving wherever they were observing everything all the way through to the end, and they cut it out into two pieces of Exhibit 1 and 2.
But did they see the video of the drug deal?
They did. I mean, they would have seen the video during the trial, and then they also requested to view it again during deliberations. Lastly, I would just like to briefly address the sentencing issue. This court should affirm the defendant's sentence in this case, the appellant's sentence, excuse me, primarily because there really was no miscalculation of a criminal history score here. The end on the right side of the Minnesota sentencing guidelines provides for 6 or more points. And the arguments that we're having here, whether or not these would even constitute a single course of behavior or however it might go, really end up being quite moot, because the defendant had 1 custody status point for being on parole still. He had 1.5 of criminal history for his Minnesota conviction of a possession of cocaine. He then would have received 2 points for the top count of the federal sale of cocaine, and he would have received 1.5 points for the felon in possession charge, which totals 6 points. So whether it's 6 or 9, his presumptive range is the exact same. The presumptive sentence is the exact same, and they're all 180 months. So it really makes no difference. And, you know, the guidelines don't distinguish between 6 points and 10 points. It's just 6 or more. And here the district court did not err in determining it was 6 or more.
Let's talk about the felony in possession charges. I mean, if a felon has 40 guns in their possession, do they get hit with 40 different...
No, Your Honor.
Charges?
They would only get the one.
Different here.
It's different here.
Different here because we've got a gun at the business, a gun at the residence.
It's different here because under 609.035, the statute specifically exempts felon in possession, either whether it's charged under 609.165 or 624.713. That's in subdivision 3 of 609.035. So what you have is a case where someone could commit, you know, an assault 2 with a firearm, and they would get a conviction for both the assault and the firearm. The statute is very clear that they are allowed another conviction for a firearm.
It's not considered a 609.035 in that situation.
Correct. It's specifically exempt under the statute in subdivision 3. And there are other, you know, similar exemptions, but firearms in particular are exempt. And so if someone commits a crime with a firearm and they're a felon in possession, they do get convictions for both, they get sentences for both. And that's explicit within the statute. So you would count those towards his criminal history, and it would be 6 or 9 if you counted all of them, but it's all the same regardless.
So as long as it's related to a drug charge, then in this situation, you can count them separately if they're 2 separate drug charges, correct?
May I answer?
Yes.
Yes, you would have. So long as you have essentially another offense, the 609.035 subdivision 3 allows a separate conviction for the firearm. So whether it's a drug sale, an assault, drive-by shooting, anything like that, 609.035 subdivision 3 allows for a separate sentence and conviction on the felon in possession.
Go ahead.
And why are these drug offenses 2 separate charges rather than part of the same course of conduct?
I would just refer to Gould. They're divided by their criminal intent in this case. The conspiracy to sale that they have with a controlled buy outside of his business is a different criminal intent than him possessing additional cocaine to sell at some other date, would be the state's argument.
Abetting, wasn't it?
It was a federal case, Judge, so it's conspiracy, but it's actually very equivalent to an aiding abetting charge under Minnesota law.
But on the sentencing worksheet, one is described as conspiracy to distribute and possess, and the other one's described as aiding and abetting distribution.
May I just take a quick look?
In reading the record, I think that at his business there was an undercover buy, or CI, a controlled buy. And that was the aiding and abetting, and then they found more cocaine at the business. That
so
was
it's a different
concern.
Location and time?
It was the same location and time. They were unified, admittedly, by location and time. It was at his business, 713, I believe it was, on Lake Street, and the search warrant was executed the same day as the controlled by.
So that presumptively would look like a 609035.
I certainly agree that there's an argument. I do think they are divided by the criminal intent, and I also think that it would be essentially moot either way because he still has 6 points, whether it's 6 or 9. Thank you.
Ms. Bond, any response?
Let's talk about the last item. Isn't it moot? Whether it's 6 or 9, it doesn't make any difference.
It's not moot for two reasons, and I agree that it is hard to see how to get, I tried, how to get the criminal history score lower than 6. I think it should be 6, not 9. And although that doesn't change the presumptive sentence, it's not moot because, number one, we have also raised an argument that this sentence is excessive and unreasonable in light of the two sentences that my client uttered that for which he is now serving 180 months in prison. And for every point that my client's criminal history score drops, that concern about an unreasonable sentence increases. And so if this court properly determines that...
There's a case law that says if you sentence them within the guidelines, that's not an unreasonable sentence.
Under Statute 244, this court can always, even a presumptive sentence within the guidelines, find that that sentence is unreasonable and excessive. And, you know, in light of this discussion, what if the court affirms the conviction, which you should not, on this sentencing issue, you know, there's two questions before this court that you're being asked to decide. Was the criminal history score correctly calculated? I think the answer to that is no, and I think counsel probably agrees the answer to that is no. And the district court should be able to then re-exercise its discretion under a correct view of what the criminal history score is and decide what the appropriate sentence is, particularly with this concern that these multiple federal offenses, which are take place in the same day or two, whether or not how many charges he should get, to me, having 6 units on his criminal history score because of these federal offenses does exaggerate the criminality of the conduct. So it is not moot for that reason.
Maybe exaggerates it for the sentencing guidelines worksheet, but it didn't exaggerate the sentence, did it?
I guess I would view that as two sides of the same coin. The worksheet calculated based on an erroneous criminal history that the presumptive sentence is 180. I agree. I'm not arguing with the fact that if he properly only has 6 points, the presumptive is still 180. What I am saying is that district courts have an extraordinary amount of discretion at sentencing, which this court regularly recognizes. And the court, in light of the argument being raised that this is an excessive and unreasonable sentence, should be able to determine what is the proper sentence under the proper criminal history score.
Was there any activity at sentencing towards a departure?
I don't believe so, but I don't recall off the top of my head.
You could have made the same argument at the trial. I mean, your client's attorney could have made that same argument at the time of sentencing.
Well, Judge, I'm not comfortable saying he didn't. I don't remember. This is a sentence where the defense contested the criminal history score, specifically raised the provision of the guidelines that talks about when it is appropriate to impose multiple points at current sentencing when you shouldn't get all those under 609035. As far as I am concerned, the defense did everything proper in this case.
Didn't argue in the alternative that...
Again, I don't remember. I think to the extent it didn't, it should have the chance to do that anew if all of a sudden we're only talking about 6 criminal history points and not 9 criminal history points. So I would submit that is all a matter that should be submitted to the district court on remand, and the court can decide those issues.
Can I ask you, because counsel for the state did make a distinction between the two charges and claiming that they're different conduct, different elements, different types of intent. Is that sufficient for utilizing both and counting both toward the criminal history?
I would say no, Your Honor. And what I am urging the court to do is rely on the racketeering case, which I can't ever pronounce, but it's the Hun, I think, case. So what we have in this case is a conspiracy charge, and then another drug charge and two gun charges. And we recognize in Minnesota that when there is something like a conspiracy or a racketeering, that the individual drug and firearm counts underneath that are all a means to commit this broader goal of the conspiracy. So my position is that what we have here from these four federal offenses is one overarching conspiracy that is drug and gun related. And in the absence of, again, this was properly objected to, which put the burden on the state to introduce the evidence it thought it needed to prove separate behavioral incidents. And it submitted the two documents. And from that, I don't believe we have anything to conclude in light of that conspiracy that there were two different intents flowing from the two different drug charges.
Is this a case that you talked about in your...
It is. Case. Yep, it is. And the case I'm... It starts... It's H-U-Y-H-N,
oh, okay.
I think.
I see.
It did go up to the Supreme Court, but the what I'm relying on is part of this court's opinion in that case that review was not granted on.
My understanding with regard to the two guns is you had the drug dealing going on at the business. That's where the cocaine was found. That's where the control buy was done. That's where a gun was found. Simultaneously, they execute a search warrant at his home. No drugs are found there. There's a gun found there. He's a felon previously. So he's charged with felon in possession with regard to that gun.
And I do think he can properly get, if we were just in regular 609035 land, he can properly get one sentence for either the conspiracy, the drug, or the one felon. Or the one felon in possession. And then we do have the felon in possession firearm exception under 609035, which talks about a single additional sentence. So I think that properly he can get one, whatever the highest is, either the conspiracy or the aiding and abetting, the distribution of cocaine, and then one additional felon in possession sentence.
So it would be 2 points for the federal drug conspiracy, say we pick that one. And then 1.5 point for the felon in possession of the gun at his house?
Yeah, I think that's right without having the worksheet. And so I think that when you take away those other two, that reduces the 3 points, which puts him back at 6. Mm-hmm. Well, I did have a lot of other issues, but I'm out of time. So we'd ask that the court reverse the conviction or in the alternative reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case was well.